Welcome to the Canadian Real Estate Investor, where hosts Daniel Foch and Nick Hill navigate the market and provide the tools and insights to build your real estate portfolio.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining us here at the Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast. My name is Nick Hill. I am joined today and every Tuesday and Friday morning by none other than Mr. Daniel Foch. And today, we are going to be looking at terms that you need to know and understand, whether you are new to real estate investing or a seasoned veteran. These terms are important for this year, especially.
Many experts and commentators in the real estate industry are predicting a hot spring market. I'm not sure if I'm one of them, but it seems to be kind of the case so far, I think. I don't know, like the CMHC thing.
It's really all over the place. Just the same amount of people predicting mortgage cuts and no cuts.
Well, we discussed the CMHC bond thing, and I think the government is trying to like kind of not, I think they're just trying to prop up the housing market, and it seems to, that part seems to be working. Like the heat of the spring market seems to be focused on entry-level product, but others are saying this year is set to be more volatile and more hardship in the real estate market. I probably would fall somewhere in the middle, but what it does mean is that if you're planning on buying or selling or investing, especially, then you want to know all these terms because you want to get a grasp for what is going on in our housing market.
Exactly, Dan. And just like most industries, real estate is full of terms that can seem confusing. If you've listened to any number of episodes on our show, you know that there is an endless number of initialisms and acronyms that have to do with real estate investing, being a real estate professional. So imagine going to try to watch the Super Bowl and not having any idea of the rules of football.
Go sports.
Yeah, literally, right? Go real estate. Well, now imagine trying to navigate through one of the craziest real estate markets in the world without even knowing or understanding some of the basic terminology or jargon. So to best prepare you for said potentially hot spring market and just the changing market conditions in the real estate industry in general, and in general, the Canadian economy, here is a list of terms that you need to know if you plan on buying, selling, investing, or even just keeping up with the market this year. Dan, hit me with the first one. What we'll do is we'll look at the term, why it matters. You can give a bit of an explanation on it, and then we'll kind of banter on it afterwards. Sound good?
Yeah. And just for context, as many of you listening know, I write articles a lot for Zolo, which is the second biggest real estate search platform in Canada after Realtor.ca, which is owned by the Realtor Canadian Real Estate Association. So they have, I would say, a pretty good handle on what's going on. And this content was made, but I actually had a ghostwriter who helped me with it. And so thank you. Yeah, I know. So Mr. Nick, thank you for helping me with this. So Nick kind of came in and helped me write this, because I was like, this would be, we use a lot of those Zolo articles for podcast episodes, but I was like, this would be a perfect one to really like kind of, let's take the most simple things that most people need to know about the real estate transaction. And so this was Nick's debut into writing an article for Zolo with me.
Turns out I can both speak and write. Who would have thought?
They call that a wordsmith. So number one, first thing you need to know, agreement of purchase and sale. This is the contract that is used when purchasing or selling a property, purchase and sale.
Hey,
and it's a page on which you agree to those terms.
It's all coming together.
I know. I mean, most of these things, like, they're not super complicated, right? But why does it matter, Nick? Tell me why this one matters.
Yeah, I mean, you need to know this one because you literally cannot do a transaction without one. Even if you do an off-market deal with a VTB and all that kind of stuff, you still need a legal contract. And that's what this is, a legal contract that is not to be taken lightly. You should have the help of a real estate professional such as Mr. Daniel Foch or any number of other great real estate agents out there to help.
They're not hard to find.
Guide you through the process.
There's one or two of them out here in Canada.
Couple, you may know one or two.
So
Dan, tell me more about an APS.
Yeah, so it is funny because you mentioned, like, even if you find an off-market deal, like, I've actually done a napkin deal before, and eventually it has to become a, like, yeah, the napkin could serve as your agreement of purchase and sale, but eventually in order for it to transfer, it would have to be I didn't actually do it on a napkin, by the way. But
lawyers and accountants, they don't like napkins or a shoebox full of receipts or any of that kind of stuff. They want to see it a bit more, you know.
Yeah. So anyway, so the point being, when a lawyer transfers the deed of a property, they will need an actual legal document to do that. And the agreement of purchase and sale is what that is. So usually the first iteration of an agreement of purchase and sale will be done by a realtor, by a real estate professional, but then eventually it gets done more professionally, no offense to realtors, but by a lawyer, which stipulates like everything, all the mortgage conditions, et cetera. So there are kind of two phases to that. So essentially it's a document that the buyer submits to the seller. So it's an, you'll often hear the word offer. This is my offer to purchase your house. And so the buyer submits it to the seller when offering to purchase a home. It outlines the price, deposit, typically closing date, irrevocable date, which means that legally binding and cannot be revoked during that specified time period. And it can't be canceled during that period of time unless both parties agree. So irrevocable means you can't take it back. If the seller accepts, then the agreement can only be terminated by mutual consent, or if the agreement's terms and conditions permit it. And conditions are things like financing, home inspection, insurance. We're seeing a lot of, you know, second time homebuyers, sometimes sale of buyer's property would be another condition. But conditions are basically legal reasons that you could get out of the deal.
Yeah, exactly. And why is this important for 2024? Because it is a hectic market out there, and you need to know and understand that this APS is one of the most important legally binding documents. And although simple, we have seen mistakes made on them, which can be very costly to both the buyers and sellers, the end users or the investors, but also to the professionals that are guiding those people through. So something to be very aware of. The next one
comes from the Latin word amore, or the Italian word amore.
Love.
Yeah, it actually comes from the Latin word amort, which means death.
Love, death, and real estate, the only three things certain in this life, I guess, in Canada.
Taxes.
And taxes, yeah, of course. Cool. Lots of those.
One or two of those.
We won't get into that. That's a different episode. So the next term that you need to know for this year is amortization. That is the period. It's the length of time it takes you to pay off your mortgage in full. And why it matters is because understanding your mortgage is absolutely crucial these days with changing rates, rising inflation, and general economic uncertainty in this country.
Can I just interject here? For those of you who haven't been listening for a long time, Nick is Italian. Even though his last name is Hill, he's actually Italian. So when he like makes jokes like that, he's being like, he's, you know,
I'm just being me. Okay. My no-no has given me the blessing.
Yeah. So
thank you for clarifying that, Dan.
I just wanted to clarify because...
No cultural appropriation here. This is just me being me.
Yeah, there you go.
So, and also amortization sounds better than amortization.
It's a good way for people to remember it too. And also exactly. I mean, the easy way too, because we talk about, this is why we always bring up Latin. It's like, you know, when you, remember those Lemony Snicket books where you'd be like.
Series of Unfortunate Events.
Yeah. Oh, it's a word that means this. And then we say, oh, it's a word. And then you remember it. Yes. And now all of a sudden this guy's teaching you so many great words.
Who, me or Lemony Snicket?
Both. All of us. Me too. With a Latin. Because now people are going to think, oh, amortization. And they're going to think death. Not love, right? Anyway.
Your amortization will have a direct effect on how much interest you pay through the life of your mortgage. The more you know about these numbers, the better you can budget your personal finances, the better you can understand either one of the biggest purchases of your life or your investments. Now, amortization combines interest and principal in payments, allowing you to build home equity. It's displayed as a schedule, an amortization schedule, and it's included in your mortgage document so you can clearly see how much principal and interest you're paying off over the life of the mortgage. Now, simply put, the amortization period refers to the number of years needed to pay off your mortgage in total. This mortgage length can impact the total interest paid. Now, the standard here in Canada is traditionally about 25 years, but other durations may be available depending on your down payment. And if your down payment is under 20% of your home price, the max is 25, but we have seen 30. And now, of course, when we get into the CMHC MLS Select space, we're seeing them go all the way up to 50 years.
Yeah, that or the static payment variable rate mortgages, which are, Vince calls them Buzz Lightyear mortgages.
Yes, they go to infinity. Beyond. Yeah, but Vince Gaetano, who also just launched a podcast. You were just on
Dan. Great.
Go check out Vince's podcast, The Wise Old Owl.
He is that. He's very, he's a sobering voice in the, in the industry. That's, Okay, so let's talk about this amortization, because we presented a picture of the amortization schedule in the course, and I said this is one of the most important charts in real estate. And the reason is because it shows your principal balance going down, but it shows how each year that goes by, you pay less interest and more principal. Why?
Remember, principal is actually what makes you more own more of the house, whereas interest is just money literally flying out the door right into the bank's coffers.
Yeah, it's a sunk cost.
Yes.
It's money that's gone. And so when you make a mortgage payment, when you make a purchase, the one of the primary reasons why I would personally rush into buying real estate, because I would never encourage anybody to, I don't think you need to be in a hurry. I don't think there's a way to time the market. I don't think there's FOMO, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, of course.
I don't think always a good time to buy and sell, only goes up, none of those things. Yeah. The one reason why you should want to buy a property sooner rather than later is so that you can start having that amortization schedule paid down. The sooner that property one is amortizing itself, killing its mortgage, if we're going to go back to the Latin roots, right? Killing it, the death of that mortgage, then it starts building equity, paying itself equity through principal pay down. And every single principal payment that goes by, your principal balance goes down, which means the amount of interest that you owe on that mortgage now is going down, because the amount of money that you're borrowing is going down.
And the amount of ownership that you have in that house is doing the opposite. It's going up.
Right. And so when you think about ideas like compounding, this is a very good example of real estate compounds by gradually increasing the speed at which it pays itself down. And so if you can buy, the sooner you can buy property number one, the sooner property number one can amass enough equity that it can buy you property number two and property number three. This is another reason why we really encourage people, especially beginner investors, to focus primarily on cash flow or capital accumulation rather than equity growth, because equity growth requires you to wait until you can do a refi or sell a property, whereas this is a very predictable way. Okay, I know I have this much money coming in, and so you can model something off of something that's predictable, whereas capital appreciation is not predictable. Amortization is on a schedule. It's scheduled. It's that predictable.
It's got its own morning routine. It gets up every morning.
Every morning. And amortizes stuff. Yeah. Takes an ice bath.
Okay. Yeah. No, again, very, very important for both investors and end users. So definitely be aware of what that is. And if you have a mortgage, you have an amortization schedule. And if you want to go check that out, you can go and see them online or reach out to your bank or lender or whoever that mortgage is held with and get them to send it over. Dan, the next one's interesting because this is something that is confused a lot, and this is why I wanted this one in here.
I can understand why it's confused, and we did a whole episode on this where we were comparing like MPAC to the BC Assessment Office. Yeah. So the term is assessed value, by the way, before I start. So, and the assessed value refers to how much the property is worth in the eyes of your local tax assessor's office.
Not in your eyes, not in my eyes, not in the 45 other people that are bidding the property up, not in their eyes either. So assessed value and market value, very different.
Well, I think the especially important point is that in BC, assessments are like relatively accurate. Like you hear sold over assessed value, sold under assessed value, because they actually want to know what every property is like worth, in quotes. Like they actually use it as a, I guess a marking point or like a data point.
Like a real
point.
Data set. Yeah.
In Ontario, your assessed value, so assessments in Ontario are revenue neutral, which means that they're just deciding how to cut up the pie. So they're saying, okay, we know that each municipality has this much value of property. And, you know, let's say there's $10 million worth of houses and in this property or in this municipality, and there's 10 houses. Okay. Each one could be worth $1 million, or one could be worth 800,000, and one could be worth 1.2 million, and one could be worth 300,000, and one could be worth 700. You know what I mean? And so you're dividing up who owes X amount of tax based on that assessment. So that's the role of an assessment in something like Ontario, whereas in BC, they're kind of a little bit more accurate. So why do assessed values matter. Knowing a property's assessed value is crucial for anyone planning to buy or sell. It's often mistaken with market value, but they are different. It estimates a home's worth based on current market conditions. Market value estimates a home's worth based on market conditions, whereas assessed value can be much less than the purchase or sale price. It refers to how much it's worth in the eyes of your local tax assessor's office. So in a province like Ontario, that's worth how much it's worth relative to your neighbor's property or to the entire tax environment. The purpose of the assessed value is to determine how much you'll pay in property taxes, which are location dependent. As an example, in a rising market like Guelph, the assessed value can be like 50% less than the purchase price because they only do these assessments I think they're planning to do another one soon, but like, I think it's like every 5 years.
Yeah. I think the last one I was getting was maybe 2016 or 17.
And then they do this like phasing in thing where they try and like grow it at what the market is currently growing at. But especially in Ontario, the market is so volatile that it's very difficult to assess accurately. And when you think about the whole universe of properties in Ontario, like there's millions. You know, the population is huge here versus like BC, which is much smaller. It's easier to assess that many properties in BC and to keep it current. Whereas I can understand why they have a difficult task in Ontario, especially in Ontario where there's the volatility and the volume, double V.
Yeah, for sure. Again, good takeaway is the higher your home's assessed value, the more property taxes you will pay. Now, again, this one's important because if you are just getting into real estate, whether a professional or an investor or an end user, and you come across the assessed value of the property that you just spent $800,000 on, and that assessed value of the property is $350,000, no, don't worry. You did not substantially overpay, as Dan just explained, assessed value and market value, especially here in Ontario, very, very different.
Yeah, and you did write in this wonderful article that while property taxes aren't usually deal breakers, it is the first letter in the acronym TMI, which I still think should be, yes, exactly, tax much information, which should be changed to TIM, really. Like, I don't know why it's not TIM. Can we just make that a thing? Taxes, insurance, maintenance, not TMI. It's commercial real estate brokers. That's why. There's got to be an initialism.
The guy who came up with this probably named Tim, and he's like, I don't want this on my conscience.
Yeah, for sure. So TMI, taxes, maintenance, insurance. I don't think I need to explain this one to you. Taxes, that's what they're referring to. Property taxes. So knowing the assessed value will help you determine your property taxes, aiding in planning and modeling out your deal and the cost of that as a real estate investor. Okay, let's go to closing costs.
All right, this one matters because it's the one-time fee you will experience when closing on a new property. Now, if you're a seasoned investor, you have been through this many times, but this is a very, very common question from, let's say, newer investors or first-time home buyers. So if you plan on buying a property, your first one or your forever one or even an investment property, you will need to budget for closing costs. There's no way out of them. These are the one-time fees that you will experience when closing on a new property. And you don't want to be caught surprised when making what could be the biggest purchase of your life. So preparing and knowing these numbers is just the right thing to do. Now, closing costs can include taxes and fees such as your land transfer tax, your legal expenses, your inspection fees, but they can vary. It's not the same for every property based off of price and a couple other things that could complicate it. So the best practice, Dan, would you agree, is to kind of budget anywhere from between 2-4% of your purchase price of your home. Maybe a bit high, but I like to err on the side of caution on this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable, especially like with adjustments. Yes. Like I've been hit with some huge curveballs on adjustments. So adjustments are, what's the easiest way to explain this? Like adjustments are things that the owner of the property before has already prepaid. For example, taxes would be a great example because we just came out of taxes. So
let's say they've paid 6 months in advance.
Or the year. If somebody gets their assessment in February or March and they prepay their taxes for the year because they're super financially prudent like that and they don't go on the schedule, right?
Totally something I would do.
Yeah, that's what you would do. So they've prepaid their taxes for the year and now all of a sudden you buy the property. They do that in February. And you buy the property in March. They're like, you know, something happened. Oh, we decided we want to sell it. Now you have to buy those taxes, those prepaid taxes off of them, basically.
Yeah.
This happens a lot with utilities as well. Like when we bought a place up north, they had oil tanks and it was really remote. So they had multiple oil tanks. It was like thousands of dollars worth of oil that we had to buy off of them because they had already pre-bought all of the oil. Because when the truck comes, rather than having, I guess the delivery fee was a lot. Rather than having them just fill one tank and keep coming back, they would fill multiple and then it would be like a huge amount, thousands of dollars, but it'd be enough for the whole season, right? But we didn't really think about this. And then we saw it in the adjustments. I was like, whoa, that's a lot of money, right? Cause they already paid for this oil and we're going to get to be the ones to consume it. So we had to buy that oil off of them. That's another really good example, right? Same thing with propane.
Yeah.
Taxes is a good example. Another huge one with when you're purchasing an investment property is rents, the rent deposit, right? First and last month's rent. If you're buying a property that somebody has already got a tenant in it and they've collected a last month's rent deposit, you're typically getting that deposit off of them. So that gets adjusted off of the price. Those are examples of adjustments.
And I feel like the rent one is so often forgotten. I mean, back in my early days, I got screwed out of first and last month's rent from a deal because I wasn't aware of those type of adjustments. So essentially, the good thing is it's stuff in the examples Dan just gave. It's stuff that you inevitably pay for anyways.
Yeah.
However, it's just unfortunate timing because you are having to pay for that as well as your legals, as well as your land transfer, at the same time.
And many of these adjustments can't be built into the purchase price.
Right, like exactly. You can't amortize these over the mortgage.
The bank's not going to be like, oh yeah, we'll just toss it in the mortgage.
Throw that oil tank
in there. Yeah, we'll give you a 25-year AM on that oil you just bought.
They want it now up front, right? It's got to be a cleared line item. So here's a quick example. Let's just say you bought a house for $600,000 because you're very smart and you're not buying in downtown Toronto. And that's just below the average price of $659,000 in January of 2024. You should budget anywhere from $12,000 all the way up to $24,000 in closing costs. Now, I know what you're going to say. I could probably get away with less, and that might be true, but isn't it better to have a little bit of money left over that feels like almost free money instead of, holy, I need to go find another $2,000-$6,000 out there.
What do they call that, girl math? Where they're like, boy math. I use a gift card, so it's free.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there you go. Boy math on
Nick just got some free money. There you go. That's realtor math right there.
Hey, that's entrepreneur math. I don't know what it is, but I've abided by it. Now, speaking of money and closing costs, Dan, talk to me about another chunk of change that is part of the purchasing process here.
Yeah. So we'll move over to the deposit, not to be confused with the down payment, because I do feel like that's like a lot. I hear a lot of people say down deposit. Which is not a thing. And then also people who, when you're talking about the deposit, they think you're talking about the down payment. So deposit it's like good faith money, right? In a lot of cases in places in the US, they call it stuff like that, right? Like, there's different names for it that are on the tip of my tongue, but escaping me right now, but, that they would use that kind of would explain it better, but it's basically just like assurance money, right? So this is a small percentage of the purchase price that is due within 24 hours of the accepted offer. In a lot of markets, like I don't think real estate professionals aren't supposed to act as though there's some sort of standard thing, but you see in a lot of MLS things now, especially with a lot of people walking away from deals. Like there were, when markets were going crazy, like with the bidding wars and stuff, people would just go offer on like 10 properties and then just not show up with the deposit. They would only show up with the deposit on the one that they wanted. Yeah. And so a lot of people were asking for like, okay, 5% deposits, right? And realtors would, in a lot of cases, will try and request a deposit that's sufficient to cover the fees. But the deposit is typically due within 24 hours of the accepted offer. The down payment is due on closing, and that's what you give to basically to the bank to secure against the value of the property. That's you buying equity out of the property. So why does this matter? Along with closing costs, as a buyer, you need to be aware of your deposit. The deposit serves as security for the seller, demonstrating your financial commitment to the agreement and good faith. It's normally due within 24 hours of the agreement of purchase and sale being accepted, unless it's otherwise agreed to. So I'll often do like two-phase deposit. So I'll do a small deposit up front, and then upon waiving conditions, I'll do a second deposit.
Right, okay.
You need that money on hand typically when you plan to make an offer on the property so that you can be agile and actually write that check to give somebody that assurance. The buyer pays a deposit on the successful purchase and sale. It's just to provide. So it's basically if you disappear the next day or decide not to finish the deal for reasons otherwise than what's outlined in the APS, like so not within the scope of conditions, you would forfeit your deposit. And we're hearing about this a lot right now with pre-constructions.
We've seen it. We've seen it firsthand. People walking away from relinquishing tens of thousands of dollars.
Hundreds of thousands. I think I posted one the other day. It was like 600K.
I saw that one.
Was brutal, man. I hate to see it.
Horrible.
But yeah, so if you give a builder a deposit as an example, 20%, and then you decide not to do the deal, you forfeit that deposit. And there might also be damages if the property has dropped in value beyond that 20% that they've already collected from you. But a deal is not firm and binding without a deposit check, also known as consideration. Like there's a legal term called consideration, which means that something needs to exchange hands to prove that the deal has actually taken place. And this is another thing where people were just not showing up with the deposits the next day. And there's really nothing you can do to chase them because they just signed a deal. But like if they didn't show up with the consideration, then it's technically not a legally binding deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where you were seeing a lot of agents, especially in, again, these bidding war things where they were asking people to actually submit the deposits with the agreements of purchase and sale. And actually the drop down menu when you're creating an offer as a realtor is like herewith, which means it's here with the offer, and then or upon acceptance, which is like, so there's a couple of different options, or as otherwise described in the agreement. Right. Those are kind of the three options that you get to put into your APS. So
how much should a, like what would a deposit look like?
I mean, I think again, I think it's like, I think the industry is trying to push for like that kind of 5% range, yeah. But in some rural markets, you're seeing much smaller.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen
companies see 1,000, 5,000.
I've literally seen everything from 1% to 10%.
I've done deposits that are like $500 before.
Yeah.
I know guys who are flipping land that are assembling land that do like tiny deposits as well.
Yeah, I mean, again, going back to what it means, it's in good faith, right? It's like, hey, I'm serious about this. It's almost like I'm putting a small financial hold on this property. So, you know, again, going back to that $600,000 example, 5% of that, your deposit would be 30 grand.
Yeah. And this money later becomes part of your down payment. Like this money you've already put into the trust account of the real estate brokerage. Typically it goes into the real estate brokerage of the property that you're purchasing, like the listing brokerage of the property that you're purchasing, gets held in trust and doesn't get deployed until the contract is, or the property is closing. And then it goes to the lawyer's trust account, which then goes to the seller.
Yeah.
But it becomes part of your down payment. So if you put 5% down as a deposit, but you're planning to put 20% down, you only need to come up with another 15%.
Yeah, exactly. Very important. This is not just extra money on top. This is built into the whole piece. Okay, great. The next term that you need to know for 2024, home inspection from the Latin word due diligence.
So do it.
Okay.
It is funny, this one, because this wouldn't have mattered like a while, like last year. Well, last year it just started mattering again, but like since COVID till the peak of the housing market, people weren't able to do home inspections.
Man, I literally, like we talked about this during in episodes back then, being like, hey, I know home inspectors and they're literally looking for jobs right now because they were not getting called. Now, a home inspection is a walkthrough of the property by a professional, not your dad, not your uncle who's going to come and kill the deal, not anyone who's just is, you know, watching enough HGTV that they think they can comment on stuff, but an actual professional who is conducting a home inspection before you relinquish those conditions, which are, again, the most common are inspection and finance. Now, why this matters?
As a dad, I can say that when you go,
how many deals have you ruined?
So when you go to the birthing classes at the hospital, they teach you the home inspection course.
Okay, now after you have your kid, you're going to get bored, okay? And 20 years from now, they're going to want a house. Yeah. You can go and say this. And
pretend you know a bunch about a house.
Oh, why that matters?
Make sure you bring a measuring tape.
It helps with legitimizing yourself. So why this matters now more than ever is because when the market was crazy, as Dan and I were just saying, people were literally just not getting home inspections. It was the craziest thing. Now, listen, the home inspection, not all home inspections are the same, right? If you're buying a condo in the downtown core of any number of cities across the country, newer condo, you likely don't need a home inspection. You should get the status certificate looked at as always, but you'd likely don't need a home inspection because the home inspector is going to walk into your, you know, 500 square foot, 600 square foot apartment and be like, yeah, this is standard. Where you do need a home inspection is anything row home, single detached, multifamily, anything where there's age to the building, there could be complicated matters. And we've seen so many people get rid of home inspections over the last few years, and they were left with some nasty and very expensive surprises. So getting a home inspection is all about knowing what you are buying. You know, we talk about KYC, know your client. Well, KYP, know your product as well, okay?
Yeah, I think this is a huge one. Like, in a lot of cases, a home inspection serves a couple of purposes. Number one is to identify anything that is going to dissuade you from purchasing the property. Any major defects that you would be like, okay.
Oh, there's knob and tube.
Right. Yeah.
That's either going to cost me a ton of money, or I can use it as a bargaining chip to go back and say, right, hey, knock 20 grand off because there's 40 grand worth, yeah, of electrical.
Well, especially if you can substantiate that in the report. Because the other thing, a lot of people don't know this, but once a seller and their agent becomes aware of a defect, like a major defect in a property, they have a legal obligation to disclose that. And so it is really a big bargaining thing, because you can now go to them and say, okay, well, you know, there's knob and tube in the house, and now that you're aware of that, you would have to disclose that, because, yeah, it's a big deal, right? You can't withhold information like that.
Don't do that.
Yeah. And so it's like, one way or another, a buyer is going to know that. So you might as well negotiate with me now. So that's number one. Number one is identifying a bad defect from the property through a home inspection. Number two is you almost get like an owner's manual, right?
Yeah. You literally have an extraordinarily detailed book of everything from your roof to your soffits, your eaves troughs, your drains in your basement, like the stuff that most people, and even seasoned guys like us, Dan, that most people, you know, kind of breeze past. Man, I've seen home inspectors go in there and notice stuff that I wouldn't notice if I spent, you know, days in the property.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting parts is that you almost get like a timeline, like a Gantt chart. You should be able to create a Gantt chart of like when these maintenance items are going to come up, so you can start forecasting those in your CapEx budgets. So remember, CapEx versus OpEx, capital expenditures are things that like basically improve the value of the property. OpEx, operating expenditures, are things that basically are necessary to operate the business or the building and business. Capital expenditures like roof, et cetera, should show up in the home inspection. Hey, you got 10 years left on this thing and then you got to replace it. So start putting those into your financial model. So now all of a sudden, you know,
exactly,
this is actually, you know, oh, do I have enough cash saved up from rent by the time the roof comes up? If not, okay, maybe I either need to know that I'm going to be paying that out of pocket, or I have to maybe think about doing another deal, right?
Yeah. And actually in our course, we built out a whole checklist for investors to go in and like, you know, there's different things you can look for on that too. Like, hey, how easy is it to put another suite in here, et cetera. So there's home inspection and there's also investor inspection, but none of that is happening. You're not even buying a place without this next one here, Dan. So what is that?
Yeah. So the next one is a pre-approval. The first step in the process of buying a home, getting a pre-approval, allows you to understand your budget. So you would go to a lender and you would ask them they would look at your financials and you would ask them for basically what you could qualify for as a mortgage. Now, this is the maximum of your budget, but it doesn't mean you have to spend that amount.
Definitely does not mean that.
Some people have this like tendency to just like max out what they can possibly spend. I would say don't do that. But anyway, so you can go through this process by contacting a mortgage broker. Do you know any good mortgage brokers,
no,
Nick?
No,
not a single
unfortunately,
one.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Or an agent. Nick's a mortgage broker, by the way, if you're a new listener. So just give me a shout. If you need a pre-approval, I think there's a link in the show notes. Just ask Nick. He's good. And they can help you run the numbers on potential purchase prices and monthly payments. They'll also give you something called the debt service coverage ratio. That's in here, right? Is it? Maybe not. No, I don't think it is. DSCR, debt service coverage ratio. This is basically how much income you would need to produce to pay your mortgage payments. Usually like 1.2, 1.25. Will come up when you get a pre-approval. Typically they'll say, oh, you need to, you know, your income needs to be this much to substantiate the mortgage. I think that's it. Another cool type of mortgages.
Yeah, another very cool type of mortgage here is the VTB, the vendor take back, also known as seller financing. This is a creative financing solution that allows property sellers to become the buyer's lender, become the buyer's bank. And why this matters is that it's 2024 and we are going to be seeing a lot more creative financing solutions and options like this as the economy continues to go through this tough cycle that we're in right now. Now, there are benefits to both the buyer and the seller when using a VTB. The buyer must still make regular payments to the seller as you would with any other lender. The interest rate is set by the seller and agreed upon by the buyer. And again, it would come with mortgage documents and all that good stuff. Why this is important is because if you are looking to buy anything other than a single family home this year, this is something that should be on your radar. I appreciate you putting that in there, Dan. We did a full episode on this. Dan just updated me onto what it was. Episode 46, how vendor takebacks can make every deal better. And they have come up a whole bunch of times throughout the last 180 plus episodes. And we have a bunch of really great content as well as some actual VTB structures in the course realist.ca. So if you're interested in those, go check that
out. It's so funny. Jamie, one of our course members, he came on and he's like, yeah, I've been listening to the show. And like, he's a contractor, just crushes it, knows how to add value. Like, and he's like, yeah, I bought three deals last year, VTB. He's like, I didn't know it existed. And then I heard it on your show and I went and just negotiated it with the sellers.
I love it.
And it was just like such an awesome, like proud dad moment. Yeah. Right. So Jamie, congrats on the VTB deals. And yeah, he's in the course as well, and we're kind of figuring out what's the next step with those things. How are we going to add the value? How are we going to strategize that portfolio that he put it together like amazingly well.
Yeah, the cool thing we did with him. So if you're thinking the course isn't for you because you own a bunch of properties, so be it. It's not for everybody, but the people that are joining that have a bunch of properties, one of the cool things that we do is we hop on and we do a portfolio audit. So we look at the highest and best use of each one of those properties, what your mortgage payments are, what the utilization of that property is, what your CapEx and OpEx looks like over the next few years. So anyways, just a quick little plug there. Dan, what is the next one? POS, another acronym here.
Yeah, careful with that acronym. Power of sale. If a homeowner stops paying their mortgage and defaults on the loan, a power of sale by the lender allows the home to be sold to pay back the mortgage. We talk about this a lot in this and the next one, which is foreclosure. Nick's going to talk about. So power of sale and foreclosure are different. In a power of sale, the lender exercises the right or the power that they have to sell the property if you're not paying the mortgage. With a foreclosure, they almost close on the property, which I'm just trying to think of like the easiest way to think about it, right? Foreclose, they take possession of it, like they close the deal, and they actually take possession of the property, and then they would sell it. We talk about both of these in distressed deals, power of sales, episode number 53,
yeah,
where we compare and contrast them. So the big thing is a lot of people think they're going to get good deals on power of sales, but actually you're not really that likely to do it because the bank has a legal obligation to try and protect the market value. So they have to keep it on the market for a long enough period of time. And they basically are making an effort to protect the seller's equity so that they're not like rug pulling the seller and just selling it out from under them, getting it off their books as quickly as possible. Power of sale is most commonly used in Ontario, PEI, New Brunswick, and Newfoundland and Labrador. Do you want to move on to the next one that is used outside of those, which is foreclosure?
Yeah, it's used in the rest of Canada, Quebec, BC, and Alberta, all abide by the foreclosure rules. And Dan, I just want to go back to your point about why there's this obsession with power of sales and foreclosures. And I think a lot of that comes from our friends just south of us where...
Well, 08 happened.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's just all the stories back then about going and buying these, quote unquote, distressed deals where you were literally getting them for actual crazy bargains. But as Dan said, it's not the same up here. So in a foreclosure, the mortgage lender will go to civil court to get that foreclosure. It's a lengthy process. The judgment in the order of the foreclosure will order that the right and title of the homeowner in the mortgage will then be foreclosed, with the mortgage lender now holding the title of the property. Now that lender has taken possession of the home, the lender will then sell the home on the open market. Since the lender owns the rights and title to the home, the lender will keep all of the money from the sale of the home. If the sale of the home did not cover the amount of the remaining mortgage, the lender cannot go after the borrower for the difference. So the defaulted borrower is semi-protected in this. Obviously, you've lost your property, but they can't go after you if that delta between mortgage amount owing and sale of the property exists. They can't go after you for that. So that's power of sale and foreclosure. Now, we're not going to go too much more into detail on either of those because we did do a full episode on them, and Dan has created some great content for our course, realist.ca, on both of those, and really how to find them, and also how to properly approach them and make sure that you are getting a good deal and not just a quote-unquote distressed deal. What is the final term here, Dan? Now, this one is a kind of umbrella term here because there's a lot of other little terms underneath that are kind of attached to this one that are going to be huge this year, and I think over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most important themes in real estate right now. I mean, we're on a call with a couple of people from the Rehousing Group. Shout out to them. We've had them on the show recently.
Go check out the website. One of the coolest websites. Yeah,
if you want to like basically figure out if you can multiplex a house almost like instantly.
And like a catalog of different houses. Yeah, like they probably have your house.
I think
there's
11
there.
Or 12 different housing types.
Yeah. 11
but they have like a pre-war bungalow, like all these different post-war houses.
Side splits. Yeah.
The most common, like the 12 most common Canadian houses, basically. Rehousing.ca. Anyway, we're hoping to do some more work with them, have them back on the show soon. But anyway, zoning is from our perspective, one of the most important things. We're seeing it change coast to coast. They're having more and more upzoning, units added to houses, et cetera. These laws can create or subtract value from you, and they dictate what activities are allowed in each zone and prescribe what types of buildings and structures and number of units are permitted on a property. It also outlines the allowable density, building height, and setbacks of the zones. Different levels of the government regulate zoning in Canada, including municipal, provincial, and the federal government even, and they seem to be trying to play more and more in that space in the attempt to solve this sort of housing crisis, this very real housing crisis that exists in Canada right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't have much to add to that. You know, Dan, I actually initially had this one as upzoning, but I figured zoning in general, right, we've seen major changes in zoning. We've seen everything from like a minor variance to all the way to changing something from farmland to commercial, from single family residential to multifamily residential or mixed use. That is where the secret power of real estate exists, because if you have a piece of land and it looks like, hey, this is a big piece of land, it's on a corner, I could probably fit a tower here, or I could probably fit a building at least five times the size of the one that is currently occupying the space. But then you go and check the zoning and you are handcuffed by single family residential. Well, too bad. But now we're in this renaissance period here in Canada where zoning changes and zoning amendments are, you know, a very acceptable thing and almost encouraged in a lot of ways. So now more than ever, this to me, and this is why I put it last, save the best for last, this is the term that you need to be aware of. You need to gain an understanding of, no matter who you are in the space, because even if you're a single family person and you're going, a single family end user, not even an investor or a realtor listening or a mortgage agent listening, and your client brings you a property, check the zoning. Check the zoning in the neighborhood. Check the neighbor's zoning, because if you buy a property and a few years later the zoning changes, or there's push to have the zoning change in that neighborhood, the neighborhood you just bought in could look drastically different.
Yeah, 100%. Completely agree. Most notable examples of this, BC just went up to multiple units.
Yep.
Toronto just went to fourplexes. Sounds like we're going to see more and more of this coast to coast. This is really the big opportunity right now. Ontario Bill 23 allowed garden suites. Garden suites are going to be a huge thing, I think, for this year, as they're starting to finally like actually make their way through the building departments. And we're excited to present some pretty cool opportunities on the financing and construction side of that. So stay tuned for that, because we're going to have some really, really cool guests on to discuss those things.
Yep. You're right, Dan. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Go check out the course that we mentioned if you are interested in leveling up your real estate investing knowledge and your network. And on that networking piece, get out to an event. Do yourself a favor and go meet some amazing real estate investors. As always, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you soon. The Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast is for entertainment purposes only, and it is not financial advice. Nick Hill is a mortgage agent with Premier Mortgage Center and a partner in the G&H Mortgage Group. License number 10317, agent license M21004037.
Daniel Foch is a real estate broker licensed with Rare Real Estate, a member of the Canadian Real Estate Association, the Toronto Real Estate Board, and the Ontario Real Estate Association.